ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 8th canto, the 8th chapter, text 21. The title of the chapter is The Churning of the Ocean of the Milk Ocean. Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryang na pungso sti ajavega nishkritam.
Viryang na pungso sti ajavega nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryang na pungsam sti ajavega krit. Nishkritam.
Viryam na pungsos chayatriya nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryam napunsasti ajavega nishkritam.
Viryam napunsasti ajavega nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Vaishnavas.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
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 Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryam napunso asti ajavega nishkritam.
Viryam napunso asti ajavega nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryam na pungso sti ajavega nishkritam.
Viryam na pungso sti ajavega nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam.
Viryam napumsasya ajavega nishkritam.
Viryam napumsasya ajavega nishkritam.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita.
Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita. Dharma kvachit tatra na bhuta suridam. Tyaga kvachit tatra na mukti karanam. Viryam na pumsa sti ajavega nishkritam. Nahi dvitiyo gunasanga varjita. Dharma, religion, kvachit. One may have full knowledge of.
One may have full knowledge of.
Tatra.
Therein.
Na.
Na.
Not. Bhuta suridam.
Bhuta suridam.
Friendship with other living entities.
Friendship with other living entities.
Tyaga. Renunciation.
Renunciation. renunciation.
Vachit.
Vachit.
One may possess.
One may possess.
Tatra.
Therein.
Na.
Na.
Not.
Na.
Muktikaranam.
Muktikaranam.
The cause of liberation.
Viriam.
Power. Na.
Na.
Not.
Na.
Pungsa. Of any person. Asti.
There may be.
Ajavega nishkritam. No release from the power of time.
No release from the power of time.
Na.
Na.
Nor.
Nor.
He.
He.
Indeed.
Indeed.
Ditya.
Ditya.
The second one.
Gunasangavarjita.
Completely free from, the contamination of the modes of nature. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila
Prabhupada.
Someone may possess full knowledge of religion, but still not be kind to all living entities. In someone, whether human or demigod, there may be renunciation, but that is not the cause of liberation. Someone may possess great power, and yet be unable to check the power of eternal time. Someone else may have renounced attachment to the material world, yet he cannot compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, no one is completely free from the influence of the material modes of nature. Purport. The statement Dharma Kvachit Tatra Nabhuta Suridam is very important in this verse. We actually see that there are many Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, and religionists of other cults who adhere to their religious principles very nicely, but are not equal to all living entities. Indeed, although they profess to be very religious, they kill poor animals. Such religion has no meaning. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.8 says, Dharmak svanustita pungsang vishlakshena kata suya no padayet yadi ratim shramahi evahi kevalam, which means such a waste of time, useless waste of time. One may be very expert in following the religious principles of his own sect, but if he has no tendency to love the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his observance of religious principle is simply a waste of time. One must develop a sense of loving Vasudeva Savramiti, Samahatma Sadurlabha. The sign of a devotee is that he is a friend to everyone, Suridam Sarvabhutanam. A devotee will never allow a poor animal to be killed in the name of religion. This is the difference between a superficially religious person and a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We find that there have been many great heroes in history, but they could not escape from the cruel hands of death. Even the greatest hero cannot escape from the ruling power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead when Krishna comes as death. That is described by Krishna himself, Mrityu Sarva Harashchaham. The Lord, appearing as death, takes away our hero's so-called power. Even Hiranyakashipu could not be saved when Nrisingadev appeared before him as death. One's material strength is nothing before the strength of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Buddhaya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Samani Tinamane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nivitesa Sunyavadi Pastracharya Satarane Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangam Mangaya Teganin Yatri Patvam Aham Vande Shri Guru Deen Tarnam Paramananda Varanam Shri Chaitanya Ishwar. Hare Krishna. So here Lakshmi Devi is continuing her search for the person to put that garland on. You can imagine her going through this whole, well, there's a lot of demigods. I don't know how many of them were there, if all of them were there. But then there were, you know, some like 33 million demigods or something like that. And she was going around with this garland trying to find who would be a suitable husband. But we can imagine her, or we're hearing her, and we will hear her for another couple of verses, going through the process of eliminating them, one after the other, why they are not qualified. So today, she's in this particular verse, she's speaking about many of them, or some of them, may be very religious, may be very practiced in their spiritual life personally, but they're not fully compassionate to all other living entities. Now, Srila Prabhupada brings this down to compassion to other animals, like animal slaughter, and he speaks very strongly about how so many people say that they're very religious and carry out their religious practices with determination, but at the same time, they're killing other animals. So that's an indication that they're not clear on the understanding that the jiva soul is present in every living entity equally, and that every living entity, from wherever it is situated, in whatever body it's situated now in that cycle. Sometimes we see that there's a poster that we have of the infinity sign in the middle, and you see birth and death, and the animals are coming out of the water and going around into the human form of life, and then coming around again into the animal form of life, and kind of goes on perpetually, live, die, repeat. But what most people, even persons who accept reincarnation, don't necessarily accept that they can go down. They kind of think that they're going to always be progressing towards some ultimate achievement of spiritual perfection. But the fact of the matter is that what we sow, so we shall reap, and many, many living entities come in the form of other species of life. And in those species of life, if they're fortunate enough to, first of all, be spared the being killed, slaughtered, then they can progress to the next species of life, and that's kind of automatic. Actually, the progression of the living entity in the animal species and through the plants and all these lower forms of life is very much like the evolution that's spoken of in modern parlance and scientific understanding, not necessarily considering the survival of the species aspect that Darwin spun it with, but this idea that it's an automatic process, that one living entity goes through many different bodies, so the bodies are progressively greater and greater and greater until one achieves a human form of life. And in the human form of life, one has the reasoning power and the mental stability to be able to take up spiritual life. But before that, one can also get mercy. And one can get mercy in the form of prasadam, even in the animal form. We read about in the Chaitanya Charitamrita how one dog was given shelter by Shivananda Sen, and that dog was fed regularly by Shivananda Sen, and then one day Shivananda Sen had to do something else, and he assigned one of his co-workers, would you please take care of feeding this dog? You have to take care of feeding this dog. I'm assigning that to you. And the guy said he would do it, but then he forgot to do it. Because there were so many devotees and he was taking care of so many arrangements, and he neglected to feed the dog. So Shivananda Sen returned and he said, did you feed the dog? And he said, no. And he was very, very upset. And he went looking for the dog and he couldn't find the dog anywhere. And then he was even more upset because he thought the dog had gone away because he hadn't been fed. And he had been neglected and he was very disturbed. But then when they finally got to have the darshan of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was the dog and there was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu throwing the meat of a coconut at the dog, and the dog was catching these pieces of coconut. So Shivananda Sen was very appreciative that this dog had gotten the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. And the next day, it says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that this dog went back to Godhead, disappeared and went back to the spiritual world. And even Yudhisthira, when the Pandavas were going back, in the chapter, the Pandavas retire timely, there's a story of Yudhisthira that a dog joined the party. There were the five Pandavas and Draupadi. And one by one, they dropped out of exhaustion or whatever on the way back. And finally, Yudhisthira was left with just this dog. This dog had joined their party and they were Yudhisthira was taking care of him. And after all his brothers and Draupadi had passed away, he was just walking with his dog. And then he came to the door of the heavenly planets, and he was denied entrance as long as he had the dog. Can't come in. Sorry, no dogs allowed. And he said, well, then I'm not going to go, because this dog has taken shelter of me, and I have obligation to take care of it. And as long as I have some obligation, I'm not going to neglect. And then it turned out that dog was Dhammaraj, and there was some gratitude expressed because he had true compassion. So the pure devotee is compassionate, but compassionate in a wise way. In the Nectar of Instruction, it's described that we relate to other living entities in different ways. The compassion of a devotee towards a tiger is not the same as the compassion of a devotee towards another human being. So we're compassionate to, and even amongst the living beings, there are different levels of compassion and different levels of appropriate behavior according to the qualification of the person, according to the adhikar of the person. So a person who's spiritually advanced, we reciprocate with them by hearing from them, by rendering service to them. And by we have peers or people who are equally equally advanced in the process of self-realization, and with them we have friendship. And we may inquire from them, and they may inquire from us sometimes, and we exchange, we get association from them, we get spiritual strength from their association, and we struggle together. Sometimes we struggle together. And that struggle together makes it easier. It's easier to struggle together than to struggle alone. So we seek the guidance and association of others to help us in our struggle. And then we're compassionate to persons who are lower than us in spiritual life, and which may mean that they've never heard of Krishna before, and they don't know about the process of devotional service. And this was very much Prabhupada's instruction to us, to be compassionate on other living entities. I really didn't have much time to do a whole lot of research, but it's interesting that just looking at compassion, devotee compassion, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third canto, there's several references to how it's an obligation of a devotee. When Kapila is talking to Devahuti, he says it's the sign of a devotee. A devotee who is not compassionate on other living entities by giving them knowledge of pure devotion is not really a devotee. That's what Kapila says. He says he's not really a devotee, and he's certainly not recognized as a first-class devotee. Unless he preaches, unless he reaches out to others and shares his knowledge, he's not really considered a first-class devotee. And then, just to answer Nick's inquiry yesterday, it says the devotee should just try to preach. And if he tries to preach, then Krishna considers him a first-class devotee. A person who's not interested in the welfare of others should not be considered a devotee. And Prabhupada, in the purport of the fourth canto, 17th chapter, 26th verse, he says he's condemned by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's like being, how many of you maybe you're familiar with the story of Ebenezer Scrooge?
Yeah.
Did you ever hear that? Westerners certainly have. I don't know if anybody from other countries have heard. But there's this story of this person who had a lot of money, and he hoarded that money, and he counted it regularly. I'm sure there's some equivalent personality in the literature of every country where there's a person who's, like, stingy, right? And he never gives any money, but he just keeps money, and he hides it somewhere under the floorboard or in a something. And he never gives anybody, even though he sees people suffering and he sees people in need of money, and he doesn't even need the money. He's already got everything he needs. But he's stingy, and he doesn't give anything. He doesn't even give anything to himself. He just spends the smallest amount. But he's always acquiring, acquiring, acquiring. So Ebenezer Scrooge, you know, people would come to him, especially on Christmas, because it's a Christmas story. So Christmas is a day, you know, supposedly we're supposed to remember the compassion of Jesus Christ. And they're looking at that compassion in a very materialistic way. They think that that means that you're supposed to, you know, feed people and give people stuff and make them happy. And so people would come and beg or go, you know, try to help others on Christmas, but not Ebenezer Scrooge. He wouldn't help anybody. He didn't want to give anybody anything. So even when people who worked for him said, "Can I have a day off? Can I go to be with my family on Christmas?" then he would say, "No, you have to work. You have to work. You have to work. What do you mean, take a day off? What are you talking about?" So he wouldn't let them go anywhere. And even they were asking, "Can I have my paycheck a little in advance, something small, so I can buy some present for my son or something?" "No, what do you mean, asking for extra? Forget it." So he was very obnoxious. And he's, you know, he was condemned by everybody in the society. They looked at him with scorn. And then finally, God took compassion on him. And he came to him in the form of three ghosts. And the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas future, and the ghost of the present, I don't know, something, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, the ghost of Christmas past showed him his history. And the ghost of future showed him what was going to happen in his lifetime, kind of like Magari the hunter did with, you know, with Narada. Narada showed him, "Look at, this is your behavior now. Well, what you're going to do is going to get you this in the future." And he saw all the animals coming at him in different ways. And he realized that by hurting the animals, he was going to be hurt in his future. They were going to come back and they were going to rip him to shreds. And when he saw that, then he thought, "Oh my gosh, this is, I don't want this. What can I do to rectify the situation?" And the same thing happened with good old Ebenezer. And he became more compassionate. He realized that he was hurting not only others, but he was also hurting himself. And so he took a more compassionate attitude. So Prabhupada, in various places in the Bhagavatam and in this fourth canto purport, he specifically says that even in material world, people who are not compassionate on others are condemned by society. They're considered hard-hearted and not worthy of respect. What to speak of spiritually? Prabhupada was very adamant and very much set the example that we need to be compassionate to other living entities, which means we have to give them Krishna consciousness. We can't just try to be comfortable in spiritual life. We have to go out of our way and stretch a little bit out of our comfort zone so that we can bring people to Krishna consciousness, so that we can bring people forward in spiritual life. Now, the next thing that Lakshmi talks about is... is someone, whether human or demigod, there may be renunciation, but that is not the cause of liberation. And I find this also very interesting, because very often we consider people who give up things, especially material things, and we speak about it, Prabhupada speaks about it many times, how we have to be detached from material life. And many times we consider renunciation and detachment to be equal, but renunciation and detachment are not equal. One can give up things and become very, very unattracted to the material energy, not require a lot of material things. There are people in the material world that are very austere, that live very simply, even like people who live on the street, right? If I asked you to live in the street and just carry all your belongings in a shopping cart, you would be not very inclined to live like that. It would be considered very uncomfortable. It's cold outside and it's, you know, homeless people are not considered necessarily renounced, but in some ways they are, in the fact that they would rather have no material facility or very little material facility than work. And we consider that low class. But in some ways, spiritually, if we look at the, if someone with this proper motive, that's high class. That people don't want to work, they just want to serve Krishna. And they're willing to live very simply under a tree, like the the six Goswamis were willing to live under a tree, a different tree every night. So they didn't have a house, and they certainly didn't have an iPod, and they didn't have the trappings of material existence. But their purpose was to achieve spiritual life. We don't want to be renounced for the sake of being renounced. Srila Prabhupada used to say, give me $1 million and I'll take it, and in 2 days I'll spend it and I'll ask you for another $1 million. Whereas some of his contemporaries would say, money, I don't want to touch money. Money is Maya, I don't want to have anything to do with the material world. But Prabhupada didn't say he didn't want to have anything to do with the material world. He said, give me matter and I'll turn it into spirit. Give me material things and I'll use them in Krishna's service. He was willing to use anything, right? There were no computers when Prabhupada was here. Amazingly how he did what he did without any computers. He wrote all his books without any computers, without a word processor. He didn't have Windows or any, he didn't have Skype, he didn't have any of those things. And he didn't even have a cell phone. He hated the phone, actually. Because there's one picture of Prabhupada on the phone, and it may be that Prabhupada used the phone maybe, enough times to count on two hands. He rarely used the phone. Part of the reason he hated the phone is because he would travel all the time and people would call him at ridiculous hours because they didn't calculate the time differences. And so he would get disturbed all the time. So he would just forget the phone. Plus phones were very expensive to call internationally and very complicated. I used to make phone calls in India. We had to book them 3 days in advance. You have to call the operator 3 days in advance. For me, like when I was in Vrindavan, I had to walk to Lohi Bazaar to my friend's house who had a STD phone. And then I had to call the STD operator and book the call for 3 days. And we had to make it in the middle of the night so we would get the open line, because if you tried to call it and the few hours that are pleasant for both the West and the East, they would be so busy you wouldn't be able to get through. So you'd book it in the middle of the night. So that meant in the middle of the night, 3 days later, you had to go back there and just wait by the phone. And then the operator would call you and say, I have your phone call. Are you ready? And then you'd get on the phone and you'd be screaming, like almost like you didn't even need a phone. You could be heard by just shouting, because you'd have to scream so loud in order for the phone call to be. And you'd get 10 words, 15 words, and then the operator would say, 3 minutes are up, and then the connection would be finished. So, and that would cost, like $10. So, this phone, we take it very for granted now. Everybody has, at least one phone. And, you can call the world in a minute, but it wasn't always like that. But the point is that our philosophy is yukta vairagya, which means using things in the service of Krishna. It isn't just renunciation for the sake of renunciation. And actually, Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion, he says, Upadeksham Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he says that if you renounce prematurely, if you're not really ready to give up things, and you give them up prematurely just for the sake of renunciation, then your heart becomes hard. And you become like Ebenezer Scrooge. You become materially constipated, unable to be kind and compassionate, because really you're harboring desire, but you're trying to cut that off artificially, and so you become hard-hearted. Devotees are very soft-hearted. Their heart is like butter. So they're not attracted to the material things because they're attracted to Krishna, not because they're trying to cut their attachment to material things. That comes automatically. That comes as a result of pure devotional service. It's not something that we go for, renunciation. But it comes from engaging in Krishna consciousness. And because Krishna understands that we may have some residual attraction for some material things, he gives us opportunities to use those things in Krishna's service. So he gives us, for instance, deity worship. And in deity worship, we can use many, many beautiful things, right? We like to have beautiful things. So we can use beautiful things in the service of Radha Gopinath. Beautiful jewelry, beautiful cloth, and we can make things look beautiful. So when we look at the deities, we have a festival for the eyes. For our own selves, we just wear very simple attire. I was once in the room with Srila Prabhupada in Mayapur in 1974. And Srila Prabhupada was speaking about how in Vedic society, you could always tell a person's position by some marking on them. In other words, like a married woman, you know she's married because she wears red in the part of her hair. A brahmachari, you know, because he wears saffron cloth and he has the piece in the back of his dhoti. A sannyasi, you know, because he has lungi and he's carrying a stick, or he's wearing his cloth in a certain way, so you can recognize that he's a sannyasi. A grihastha man, or one who's at another stage of spiritual life, he's wearing white cloth. So different attire allows a person's position to be ascertained by others in the society, and it allows them to interact with appropriate etiquette. You know how to act towards a sannyasi. If you can't recognize him, then you won't know to offer obeisances or to offer respect. So he's dressed in such a way that we can see, this is a sannyasi, I should bow down. This is a married woman, she's not available to me. I shouldn't consider any kind of relationship, but she's already with somebody else. This is a brahmachari man, I should keep my distance if I'm a woman. He's trying to be a celibate student. So different realizations or different etiquette we have, different sadachar we have when we see a person's attire. And then Prabhupada, after he went through the list, he said, but in our society, everyone dresses simply. So one of my god sisters, she said, well, Srila Prabhupada, what about if your husband buys you fancy saris? Are you not supposed to wear fancy saris? Prabhupada said, you can wear them, but you should wear them when your husband is here. When your husband is not here, you shouldn't wear them, because who are you trying to attract? He said, Krishna is not attracted by people wearing fancy saris. So anyway, then there was a whole other discussion and a few minutes, and then ultimately someone said, well, Prabhupada said they should treat you as mother, they should see you as mother, and they should treat you as mother. And then one devotee made a comment. He said, well, I think, Srila Prabhupada, that they think when, that prayer, when they say, whenever I think of sex life, I spit on it, I think they think whenever I think of women, I should spit on them. So Prabhupada said, he closed his eyes for a few seconds, and then he said, first let them become free of sex desire, then let them spit. So this is the problem when renunciation precedes spiritual advancement. That if we try to renounce prematurely, we spit on the wrong thing. We hate the object of our attraction, and we think the object of our attraction is responsible for us falling down. But really, the fall down is due to our lack of spiritual advancement and our lack of ability to control our senses. So certainly we should behave in appropriate ways and minimize our association with the objects of our attraction. But the best thing is to use those things in Krishna's service. Because when we use them in Krishna's service, we see that this thing, whatever it is not harmful. It's my attachment that's harmful. It's my attachment to that object that I need to work on. And that is an internal thing. It's not an external thing. A knife can be a very valuable thing. It can be used to prepare an offering for the Lord. But it also can be a very dangerous thing. It can kill somebody. If we use it in anger, it can be used to harm somebody. So we have to understand that what's going on in our heart is really what's causing us to act appropriately or inappropriately. And just cutting off connection with the outside world will not necessarily give us pure devotional service. And so here Lakshmi Devi is saying, even the demigods, they may be renounced. They may appear to be very renounced. Lord Shiva, he's very renounced, right? He's very renounced, and she'll address him in a future verse, not in this verse, but in another verse. But he he may have other problems. I don't want to give it away, but she talks about he may have other problems later. And we see that Lord Shiva went to Krishna and said, I want to see that Mohini Murti form. You know, I'd like to see it. I heard it was pretty far out. I'd like to check it out. Krishna said, you sure? He said, yeah. He said, you might have a problem. Nah, I won't have a problem. But he had a problem. So, but materially speaking, he was living under a tree. He's just wearing very little, and he's very renounced, right? He's very renounced. So, may not be the cause of his liberation, Lakshmi says. Just because he's renounced, that doesn't mean he's Krishna conscious. Just in Lord Shiva's case, he's the greatest Vaishnava. But in many cases, we see people who are renounced, who have very little, but it's not because they're devotees, even, or advanced devotees. So renunciation doesn't equal liberation. And some may possess great power and yet be unable to check the force of eternal time. And actually, no one can check the force of eternal time. Prabhupada brings up Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu was trying to become immortal, right? He went to Krishna, or he went to Lord Brahma, and he said, I want to be immortal. And Lord Brahma said, well, I can't make you immortal. I don't have that benediction myself. How can I give it to you? So he devised all different kinds of ways. I can't be killed by a human being. I can't be killed by an animal. I can't be killed by the day. I can't be killed in the night. I can't be killed inside. I can't be killed outside. So he thought, okay, I've covered all my bases. Now there's no way I can be killed. I can't be killed by humans or animals. What else is there? I can't be killed inside or outside. What else is there? I can't be killed in the day or the night. What else is there? But he got killed. Because no one can escape eternal time. Eternal time breaks down everything. And Krishna will figure out a way on the door opening between in and out at the time of the junction, the sandhya, between sunlight and dark, and create a come as Nisringadev, who's half lion and half man. So in that way, he was able to show Hiranyakashipu that even someone who had so much power that he terrorized the entire three planetary systems, still he lost. Still, when it came to eternal time, he had to give in to death. And someone else may have renounced attachment to the material world, but he cannot compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because Krishna is full in renunciation. So even though someone may renounce material things, he may be attached to something more subtle. He may be attached to profit, adoration, and distinction. He may be attached to being attached or detached, right? He may be attached to being detached. Once I was listening to a class in Mayapur, I think it was Jai Pataka Maharaj, but it was many years ago, and he was saying that, you know, there's a train in Vrindavan called the Radharani Express. Most people don't know about the Radharani Express. It doesn't run very much anymore, but it used to run fairly regularly. Now it runs kind of whenever it wants, and it goes from Mathura to Vrindavan. And it comes in a rather odd place. It's not like near what we consider to be the heart of Vrindavan right now. It's kind of odd. Anyway, the train runs very sporadically, and sadhus are allowed to go on that train for free. They don't have to pay anything. And it doesn't cost hardly anything anyway. But very often when you were traveling from Mathura to Vrindavan, you would take this train from Mathura, and you would see these sadhus, and they'd be wearing nothing but ash and a chain around their waist and some small piece of cloth. So they were proud of their renunciation. Their renunciation was something that they were not renounced about. They were renounced materially, but they were proud of their renunciation, so their pride would be something that would tie them to the material world. Because you can't be proud of your renunciation. Renunciation has to come naturally. And if you're proud of anything, then that pride will lead you to fall down. And so only the Supreme Personality of Godhead is renounced from everything. He's totally unattached to anything. And yet he's the most compassionate, compassionate on all living entities, the friend and well-wisher of every living entity, and therefore he can be perfectly renounced. So Lakshmi is seeing that this is his quality, that he's perfectly renounced, because his renunciation is tempered by compassion and affection for all devotees and devoid of all envy and all pride. And therefore, he is completely free from the modes of material nature. Only the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is her reasoning. And we can look at that reasoning and we can consider in our own lives also how we can control these tendencies and look for the qualities in a person that will allow them and us to become, to see their spiritual acumen, to see their spiritual advancement. We can look, like she's looking to see who is the most advanced. Of course, she's looking for Krishna. And we're also looking for Krishna, but we also have to have relationships in the material world. And within those relationships, we should seek out those people who exhibit the qualities of pure devotion, and we should get their association, because association with those persons, it's described, Mahatseva Dwara Mahorvi Mukte, that the association of Mahats, or great saintly persons, opens the door to the spiritual world and allows us to enter into association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I'll stop there and ask if there's any questions we can discuss. Any questions? Is everybody awake?
So compassion, like basically you're talking about compassion. Compassion is give them Krishna consciousness, or
compassion is mostly give them Krishna consciousness, but also, materially speaking, people can't take to Krishna consciousness unless their basic needs are met. If someone's starving and you try and preach to them, better to give them prasadam first. Because if they're starving, they're not going to listen to you. They can't think about anything but hunger. You know, when you're tired, even, it's very hard to think about anything except going to sleep. You just, you know, when you get really tired or when you're freezing cold, it's very hard to think of anything but getting warm. You can't consider, it's hard to fix your mind on a lecture if you're sitting and you're freezing. So, you want to get warm or you want to eat. So that's why Sunday feast lectures should be short, because everybody's meditating on a Sunday feast. And if you make the lecture too long, then everybody's thinking, oh, I'm going to be So we need to take that into consideration. So our compassion has to be tempered but with reality. And Prabhupada was very compassionate, even materially. And this is where the controversy comes in Food for Life, is that Prabhupada looked out the window or looked out the veranda in Mayapur and saw the children and the residents of the dam going through the leaf plates of the devotees when they threw them away. And the dogs also were going through the leaf plates looking for remnants. And Prabhupada was very compassionate. He thought no one within 10 kilometers should go hungry near any of our temple.
Yeah.
You know, within 10 kilometers or 10 miles of our temple, everybody should be fed. So, and then we hear that the grahastha should go outside, the devotees. I know when I joined the temple in Buffalo in 1969, Rupanuga Prabhu used to go outside every day on the porch and scream at the top of his lungs three times, is there any hungry man? Is there any hungry man? Is there any hungry man? And then if nobody came, then we'd honor prasadam. And if someone came, we'd feed them. And then we'd honor prasadam. So, you know, Prabhupada also told us we should have food prepared all the time. It's very nice here because you have the restaurant, so there's always prasadam. And we sell it at the restaurant, but if some hungry person comes, we're obligated to feed them. We're obligated to give them some prasadam. Fortunately, or unfortunately, actually unfortunately for them, they, not very many people in that category of people, they don't want, they want certain kinds of things, and we don't have those kinds of things, so they don't want to eat necessarily eat. Otherwise, we'd have a huge line here, right? Why wouldn't they come? And we're obligated to feed them. So the devotee is compassionate both materially and spiritually, but not materially without spiritually. And this is, Jayadvaita Maharaj has this whole lecture that he gives called Food for Death. And it's centered around this conception that we're not just giving out food, we're giving out prasadam. And we're not just giving out prasadam, we're giving Krishna. So prasadam is something that brings people closer to Krishna. We have to link them together. We have to link them together. If we just go out and give out prasadam and we don't tell people we're incognito and they don't get Krishna, then we're doing them a disservice and we're doing ourselves a disservice. Of course, they make some spiritual advancement if the food is prepared and offered to the Lord, but still, how much more advancement they could make if that prasadam was linked to the chanting of Hare Krishna, to some books or some philosophy, some philosophical exchange. So this is the great, you know, the argument that's going on in our society, that we're emissaries of Krishna and his service. And then in order to do that, we give prasadam and other things. But the interesting thing is also that Prabhupada did not consider rich people any richer than poor people. He considered everyone who didn't know about Krishna to be poor. So he wanted us to give prasadam to everybody. Everybody. He saw the millionaire as very poverty-stricken, that he needed prasadam just as much as the poverty-stricken person needed prasadam. The poverty-stricken person needs food to sustain himself, and that food should be prasadam. But the rich person is thinking, what do I need prasadam for? I got, you know, all this food. I'm a big fat schlub, and I eat whenever I want. But Prabhupada saw him with as much sadness and compassion. Prabhupada was driving by a golf course. Everybody familiar with golf? Yeah. You know what that about this stupid game where you hit a ball into a hole? Okay, so and you pay a lot of money to do it, and you don't get any exercise because you ride around in a car, and then you get out and swing a stick at a ball. And
yeah.
So Prabhupada saw these vast fields of beautiful grass and plants and everything, and these old men standing there with a stick hitting a ball into a hole. And he started to cry. He said, just see how sad it is that these people, when they should be taking up spiritual life, because they're going to die soon. Usually golf is, you know, older people, 50, 60 years old, playing this game. And instead of taking up spiritual life, there they stand with a stick hitting a ball into a hole. Right? That's what they do in their spare time. It's very pathetic. And all that land that could be used to grow food, they say that there's a shortage of food, a shortage of land, but there's no shortage. There's just misuse. There's misuse. So Prabhupada felt the same kind of compassion for the rich materialist as he found for the poor person. And actually in our Shastra, we find several stories of poor people who were very spiritually advanced, and rich people, or even spiritually advanced, apparently spiritually advanced people, who were very spiritually deprived. Right? We have the story of the cobbler and the Brahmin, and Narada Muni going by, and the cobbler saying, would you please ask my Lord when I'm going to go back to him? And the Brahmin saying, oh, you're going to go see Narayan, could you ask him when I'm going to go back to him? And so Narada goes and asks, well, you know, there's two people, they asked me the same question. He said, well, tell the cobbler, this poor person who basically just lives under a tree and fixes shoes, which is not very suchi, it's muchi, just tell him he's coming back to me in this lifetime. And tell that other guy who's doing all the jagas, who's, you know, very aristocratic Brahmin, you tell him he's not coming back for many lifetimes. So Narada was confused. Well, how is that? Why is that? He said, you go tell them, you'll understand. So he went and he told the cobbler. First he went and told the Brahmana, and the Brahmana accused him of lying. He said, you didn't really see Narayan. Narayan really didn't tell you that. You're just putting me on. You're just lying to me. And so because Narayan told Narada, if they asked you what I was doing, if they want proof that you saw me, and they asked you what I was doing, tell them that I was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. So when Narada told that to the to the Brahmin. The Brahmin said, that's ridiculous. Why would he waste his time? And how could he do such a thing? The eye of a needle is so small. Elephant is so big. That's absurd. You didn't really see Narayan. You're just a hoax. You're a sham. But when he went to the cobbler and he said, I went to see Narayan and he said, oh, what was my Lord doing? Please tell me, what was he doing? He was threading an elephant through an eye of a needle. Wow, that's fantastic. He was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. Oh, my Lord is so wonderful. And Narada said, you believe that? You really believe that he was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle? How is it possible? He said, of course it's possible. I'm sitting under this big banyan tree, and you see there are so many here. There are so many seed pods. And if I open the seed pod, there's so many seeds. And in each one of those seeds, there's an entire banyan tree. Right? This huge banyan tree is in this little seed. So if my Lord can put a seed in a tree inside the seed, then what's the big deal about threading an elephant through the eye of a needle? No problem. So then Narada could understand that the faith and the conviction of these people was not commensurate with their external appearance, their external show of wealth, or their external show of spiritual advancement. So yes, we're compassionate, but we're compassionate on everybody to give them spiritual life. Even the richest person needs our compassion. The poorest person also needs our compassion. How's that for an answer? Hare Krishna. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna. I have a question.
Yes.
A million times maybe I've read Srila Prabhupada about liberation. And so you were explaining the line that even though somebody is renounced, that's not the cause of liberation, right? You explained that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you went on to say that one example you gave is Srila Prabhupada said, give me the money and give me some money tomorrow and I'll use it in Krishna's service. Mm-hmm. So this is intelligent use of Krishna's wealth, mm-hmm. albeit material wealth. So if you could just maybe like in a sound snippet so that I can give this to my friends I might see on the street or to my family, so I can explain this to them, just so I can remember a little bit better. In your own words, what is the cause of liberation?
First of all, liberation, Prabhupada uses that word in many, many different ways. This is a slippery slope word. If it were, if we had it in a dictionary, which was a compendium of all the uses of the word liberation, there's many, many uses of the word liberation. So the most common use of the word liberation, it means one has reached the stage of Brahman realization, meaning that he's free from material entanglement. Okay, he's not pulled to the material world for its own sake. Okay? So, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's pulled towards Krishna. He may not even know about Krishna. An impersonalist is liberated. If he has no attraction to the material world and he merges, but he's not attracted to the material world. He doesn't see the material world as his source of happiness. That's liberation. So a person who's attracted to Krishna and uses everything in Krishna's service is more than liberated. I mean, he's also liberated. If like you had a Venn diagram, you know what a Venn diagram is? A Venn diagram is when you have circles representing other things and they overlap according to how much they, like men, women, humans.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you had a Venn diagram, everybody that's liberated is not a devotee, but every devotee is liberated.
Gotcha.
Okay? So, but for a devotee, it's more than liberation. It's not just liberation, because a devotee understands I need to worship, I have to give everything to Krishna. Whatever I have, I don't look at it as an object for my own pleasure. I look at it as an object with which I can give Krishna pleasure. And that's higher than liberation. So I don't know what you want to explain to your family. If you want to explain to them why you don't want wealth, or you want to explain to them what is the dialogue about? Are they looking for liberation?
I was wondering if the cause of liberation was actually Krishna's mercy. Or was it that I can actually see Brahman, that I can actually see my proper constitution?
Well, the cause of liberation is Krishna. Krishna
That's
is
right.
Sarva Karana Karanam. He's the cause of all causes.
That's right.
So Krishna is the cause of liberation. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the four verses in the 10th canto, it says that Krishna is sitting within the heart and he gives us the knowledge by which we can come to him. So he has to remove the darkness of ignorance with the torchlight of knowledge. He has to do that. But we have to kind of encourage him to do that.
Right, by our actions.
By our
sacrifice and surrender.
Exactly.
So we know that Krishna's mercy is causeless,
mm-hmm.
but there's a cause.
Well, no, it's causeless in that he can do what he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
But we also want to do what he wants. You know, it's like I say, my mother, you can tell your mom, okay, mom, your love for me is causeless. Because I'm, you know,
yeah.
I'm your son and you just love me.
Yeah.
Whatever I do, you'll love me anyway, I hope. But at the same time, you want, I should reciprocate with that. And I should feel that because you love me causelessly, I should act in ways that will serve you. Because your love inspires me to offer things to you, to do things for you, to clean up the kitchen after I make a mess, to put my clothes away, to listen to what you say, because you've served me with love, therefore I feel obligated to you. That's why Prabhupada was so disturbed by the Christian conception of confession, that you go to confess your sins, you accept that Jesus accepts your sins, and then you go and sin again. And Prabhupada felt that was very selfish, the idea of feeling it was okay to do anything, because if I accept Jesus as my savior, then I just charge it to my JC credit card and it's cool, you know. So Prabhupada saw that as extremely selfish and arrogant. So what causes liberation? Krishna causes liberation. But at the same time, we have a feeling in our heart, some sense of love for Krishna, and out of that love for Krishna, we serve him. At the beginning, it may be tinged with some desire to, you know, achieve some kind of success in spiritual life. But the ultimate level of loving Krishna has no payback. Mm. The gopis have no payback. They want no payback. If they have to go to hell to give Krishna the dust of their feet to get rid of his headache, they'll do it. They don't care. But you're going to go to hell. I don't care if I go to hell. I'm more concerned about Krishna's headache than I am about my blah, blah, whether I'm liberated, whether I'm free. Westerners, non-spiritualists find this very difficult to understand. The concept of selfless love is very difficult to understand. And the closest thing, Prabhupada says, to it in the material world is the love of a mother for her child. That's the closest thing in the material world to causeless love. Every other love has a payback. So, you know, it depends on what the discussion is with your family or your friends, whatever, which direction you're going to take this discussion.
Maybe it's a discussion also.
Are they looking for liberation? I mean, you know, we're discussing liberation. Are your friends looking for liberation? They want to know how to get it. Do I get it from Krishna or do I get it from renunciation? I kind of doubt it.
I happen to be actually reading sort of the fourth chapter with my brother. We're reading the Bhagavad
fourth.
Gita together.
Oh,
right.
Awesome.
We're reading the Bhagavad Gita together.
That's
and now
great.
I'm gotten to the part where I'm practically reading everything. So I'm reading the purport and the verse. I'm not just like Vaishnava Guru says, Chad, you know, just the verse. I'm doing the purport because the purport is so necessary, I think. So anyway.
I hate to say it, but Prabhupada gave his lifeblood to those purports.
Yeah, like the
I mean, that's what Prabhupada said. Those were his personal ecstasies. You can't leave them out. Sorry.
And so many purports are like an encyclopedic answer. There's so much more that Prabhupada could have said, but he's just giving the most absolute necessary points in many of the purports. It's just bam. Each sentence is like bam, 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 bam.
Mm-hmm.
I saw yesterday was liberation, and I was trying to explain. I'm thinking, who am I to try to tell my brother what liberation is? But a little bit like it because it was there. And so if the cause of liberation is actually Krishna,
mm-hmm.
the impersonalist is liberated because he can see Brahman. He can right. see, and he can Krishna, understand Aham Brahmasmi.
And Krishna is the giver of that liberation, but they don't perceive
but
the connection.
They don't know that. They right. think that they're liberated by their own austerities.
Exactly.
So they actually don't know what the cause of liberation is.
Exactly.
So it's difficult. So
they don't even know. I mean, the aspiration to nothingness, which is what you're talking about, the aspiration to disappear into the void. What is the void? If I ask you, what is the void? You get answers like we got the other day from this man, you know, just energy, it's...
The blissful thunder.
It's blissful, it's big, it's buzzy, it's, you know... how do you define that? How do you define an impersonal relationship? That's what I asked him. I said, could you please define for me an impersonal relationship? To me, those two words together are oxymoronic.
Exactly.
You know, so, but still...
It's like saying dry water.
Yeah, dry water, hot ice. So this conception is not even clear. So they say, you know, I'm aspiring for liberation, but they don't know what that means, and they don't know where it comes from either. That's okay. You know, if you're happy with that, go for it until you get a higher level of understanding, and then you'll go on. But to, as long as you're looking for nothing, that's what you're going to find. You're going to find nothing. You're not going to find Krishna because he's something.
There's like so many, like, because I was listening yesterday, or was it this morning, and I was dressing Prabhupada, so, like, it's technical for the Ashtanga yogis, or yanis, it's technical. They have a technical, the predisposition to a technical understanding of things. Mm-hmm. Ravida Prabhu was talking about that. I mean, I'm listening all day, so Ravida mm-hmm. Prabhu was talking about that in, I don't know, maybe the fourth chapter, because I'm listening to him read it too.
Sixth chapter, Ashtanga
yoga. Yeah, it's technical. They have a technical understanding. And so when I went to India and I studied Shivananda yoga, it's like, they're nice, my body's like that.
Nice.
But there are so many, like, I think, maybe, I don't know, more women than men, but I think there are so many people that are just ready to be devotees. And they don't understand that this impersonalist approach that, you know, they got to merge and grow on. They actually don't understand that that's not what they want. They actually want a personal relationship. That's what they do, actually, in their real time. Mm-hmm. We all meditate together. It's 6 o'clock
yeah,
morning,
so you well, that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
That's what you're here for. That's what I'm here for. That's what you're here for.
Yeah.
We're here to tell them that. That's what these books are here for, to tell them that, to show them something different. And not only tell them, but show them. Show them by our behavior, show them by giving prasadam, show by establishing a relationship, show them by seeing the relationships between the devotees, show them by chanting the holy name. They have to come to a higher realization. And plus, Krishna will show them also because they'll become dissatisfied. When you get to the top of the mountain, you see it's just the top of the mountain. There's another mountain over there. You know, so what? It's dissatisfying. An impersonal relationship is dissatisfying because there's no such thing as an impersonal relationship. You can only have a relationship with a person. You can't have a relationship with nothing. If you could have a relationship with nothing, you could stay in your room and sit in an empty room and be completely happy. But people aren't happy for very long in that situation. That's why everybody has a cell phone and two cell phones and Facebook and God knows what else. And even though they have all those things, still they're lonely.
Because they're doing it right.
They're trying to take the pain out of personal relationships. So they're making personal relationships more and more impersonal and trying to keep a facade of personalism. So they have emoticons that make you, you know, like smile and hug and kiss. But you're not doing any of those things, really. It's just virtual, you know. And so I have, you know, 1,685 friends. I don't know who 99% of them are. So what is that? You know, it gives you a feeling that you have personal relationships. But in reality, you're becoming more and more impersonal. And studies of coming up by the gazillions now among psychiatrists and psychologists that people are suffering from such a strong tendency to loneliness now. Even though they think they are so connected, they're suffering greatly because they're so lonely. And you can see they're walking down the street, two people, one hand is holding hands and the other hand is on their iPhone.
Yeah.
They're both talking to other people.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So there they are, they're connected, but they're also disconnected. Mentally, they're disconnected. They're sitting at a table in a restaurant, and they're not talking to each other, they're talking to somebody else. They're sitting there like this. You know, what is that? So that impersonalism is spreading like a plague, and what it's doing is it's forming a barrier to personalism. And we have to break it down.
I was thinking about that as well, because people actually, they don't want impersonalism. They don't. So they want to be by themselves on their computer, but they must do it with other people who want to be by themselves on their computer. So they go in the same space in a coffee shop. So they're all together by themselves. Because we don't want to be by ourselves.
Look at these.
Really?
Like they have these games called, like WoW. It's called World of Warcraft. I can hardly say it. Anyway, they come together from all over the world and they play games on the computer. They play poker. There's people from all over the world playing games together on the computer. But what happens is, as soon as they hang up, those people are out of their lives. There's no obligation to those people, really. There's no loving relationship between those people. Those people are not there for each other beyond the screen of that computer. As soon as they close the lid on their computer, that relationship disintegrates. It goes away.
Is that because people, they don't want to be responsible? Is that what's part of these gazillions things?
Yeah, definitely.
Don't want to be responsible?
Definitely.
Why? How could people don't want
because
to be?
People want the butt of the chicken that lays the eggs without having to have the head. They don't want to feed it. You, in a relationship, you have to give. In a loving relationship, you have to sacrifice. It's a sacrifice. Children get sick and they stay up all night and cry and they poop and they grow teeth and they take your whole day for years, forever. And to be a mother means that you have to take on that burden. To be a parent means you have to support your child, you have to feed it, you have to clothe it, you have to stay up with it, you have to take it to the hospital, you have to blah, 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 blah. It's much easier to just have a few friends on Facebook. You just say hi, Bo, and then you hang up when you're finished. And you don't have to stay up all night, and you don't have to feed it. So what you get is people, because they're so adverse to the negative aspects of relationship, that they don't get married until they're a million years old, that if they get married at all, they just play around.
So they don't want to work.
Because they don't want the obligation. They're trying to have relationship without any of the sacrifice. And so they're making relationship as impersonal as possible so that they have as little sacrifice as needed, just so they're not completely alone.
Aren't parents learning this the hard way? Like,
everybody's going to learn it the hard way. Everybody's going to learn it the hard way. The whole world is learning it the hard way. Yeah, the school of hard knocks. The whole world is learning it the hard way.
But then people end up hurting each other more that way.
Yeah, they
don't have anyone there for them.
They have no one there for them. Nobody. Just recently I went to visit some devotee who unfortunately has a severe health condition and is in an old age home. And all these people in that place, I mean, she has Krishna, fortunately, and many devotees come. But many of these people, no one comes to visit them. They're all there by themselves. And they're screaming, literally screaming and wailing and crying and banging on the piano. And, you know, it's a horrible existence because they have no relationships. So for whatever reason, during the period of their time, it seemed like a bargain that they could have their privacy and their money and their house and their car and their everything without having to share it with anybody, and now they're paying the price because there's no one to share it with anybody. So, you know, it all comes out in the wash ultimately. We get what we pay for. And I'll stop there. Thank you. Hare Krishna.